episode 22 of the Far Middle Podcast. This is Nick Deolius. Hope you're a constant listener. And as we've been doing in these prior episodes, I'm going to put a sports great to the episode number of 22. Who are we going to go with today? I thought about it for a couple of minutes this morning. I'm going to go with Emmitt Smith. Not a Cowboys fan, but I got a lot of respect for number 22, Emmitt Smith. He is, of course, number one on the all-time career rushing list for the NFL. That is a massive accomplishment in and of itself, in addition to all the other things he's achieved through his career. And I don't know if you know this or not, but I got into a debate a couple weeks ago with a friend of mine that's into sports. But I was shocked to learn that if you look at the top 20 career rushing leaders in NFL history, not a single running back in the top 20 is a currently active player. And I just got to thinking, why is that? Is it because there's been this de-emphasizing of the running back position in today's game? Is it because it's a passing league today? Is it because the players are making much bigger money with these big-time contracts and it doesn't require them long careers where they're racking up all these yards but also abusing their bodies? Or is it a little bit of all the above? I suspect it's a little bit of all the above. By the way, honorable mention, my number two pick for episode 22, naming rights, was the Oriole great Jim Palmer. What an awesome pitcher he was. But we're going to go with Emmitt Smith on this one. Now today, like we've done in some prior episodes, we're going to link together for you a number of timely connections, all of them relating to a theme of true versus created threats to humanity, to people, whether it's in this country or all over the globe. What are the legitimate, and you've been hearing this term, I think, if you've been watching the news lately, code reds for humanity? Which ones are legitimate today, and which ones are either manufactured or constructed or sort of overblown and become distractions or maybe convenient distractions, depending on who's making the claim? And when we discuss this theme and these individual connections that tie to it, we're going to walk through five individual pieces of this that I think you'll find really interesting. First, we're going to talk about the true facts and data with respect to climate change that you probably don't hear or won't hear being reported in the news today. There were some interesting conclusions, results, and findings that were published recently on the issue of climate change that you don't hear about, and you should. We're then going to talk about the medical profession, of all things, and how the medical profession these days, or at least the leadership of it, the biggest worry isn't a host of hazards that you have in health in modern society, COVID, cancer, et cetera, but instead it is climate change of all things and why that should trouble you as a patient or a customer of the medical profession. We're then going to talk about, while doctors are worrying about things like climate change and what CO2 is doing, they're not worrying about things that they should be focused upon because it does affect health and well-being. One of them being big tech these days and the impact that big tech is having on the human condition and the human mental state versus something like weather. And then we're going to jump from big tech to another problem that's out there affecting health and wellness that the medical profession doesn't seem to be too concerned about, but should be, which is how kids these days, and particularly kids and minority kids in our big cities and our urban school districts, they have to be subjected to a crumbling education system that is really tapping their potential and not allowing them to, capping it in a way where they're not allowing them to realize that potential down the road. That's a tragedy in the making. And then we're going to wrap with our last bullet, going from sort of big tech and its worries in terms of what impact it's having negatively on human health and condition to our public education system in our larger cities and what it's doing to the potential of a lot of our kids, to the last one of how the middle class and the working poor, whether it's kids or their families, they are getting hammered today by the rising cost of housing. And that whole issue of less affordability or reduced affordability with housing and the negative consequences it has for health and for quality of life and with respect to potential of the middle class and the working poor, it's all been self-induced, unfortunately, by government. So a lot to talk about today. Let's jump into it and get moving. And getting into that first topic, when it comes to climate change and what you're reading in the news versus some of the actual good news that's come out of some recent studies that you don't hear about, I guess you could label this under the headline banner of, have you heard the good news on climate change? The problem is, if it's good news about climate change, you can be sure that most of the media, and certainly the mainstream media, is going to be very reluctant, or they're just simply going to refuse to report on it. So I guess maybe the Far Middle Podcast is performing a bit of a public service of sorts when it comes to broadcasting some of these findings and facts. So first, there was this vaunted report from an entity known as the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or what they call the IPCC. Now, you talk about a bureaucratic heaven or a bureaucratic hell, this is it. It depends, I guess, on your perspective. I'm going to subscribe to the latter of it being a bureaucratic hell. These guys, however, have been messing around with climate change modeling and projections and these black box climate models for over 40 years. So they've been at this for over four decades, a very long period of time. They spent God knows how many millions of dollars on the effort. And this recent report is the sixth report to come out of the UN IPCC. So this is number six in a series of reports that they've generated, as I said, over decades. Now, when this report came out, what you heard on the news, what you saw online, what you read in the paper was doomsday and Armageddon all wrapped into one. You had reporters that were writing down and saying literally in stories that going outside will now kill you. UN bureaucrats, including a top bureaucrat at the United Nations, was calling the report a code red for humanity, right? So that's where this code red for humanity that you see everywhere now came from. That's also the title that I borrowed for the title of this episode of the Far Middle Podcast. But the headlines and the sound bites were all saying the same thing. The world is ending. If we don't do something drastic and quick, it's inevitable that it's all over. But if you dig a little deeper and you invest the time to read through this UN IPCC report, you come away with some facts or conclusions or findings that to me are the exact opposite of what's being reported. It's actually good news. And I just want to go through a few of them with you to give you a feel for that. First thing is the IPCC runs a series of scenarios. And the worst case scenario that they ran through this report number six went from what was in the prior report a 4.5-degree projected temperature increase under the worst case scenario to 4 degrees. So basically the worst case got better. That's good news. You don't hear or read about that. Another interesting conclusion I saw was that the outcomes that result in a temperature rise of 5 degrees or more. So what would have to happen to get the temperature to increase by 5 degrees or more from the baseline? They're now viewed by the IPCC as very unlikely. That's good news. Another thing was CO2 emission scenarios. So if you look at these CO2 emission scenarios and you compare them in report number six to the prior reports, they are now viewed as highly unlikely, with the likely scenarios in the current report having CO2 emissions that are about a third lower than before. Why is that? Well, it's things like energy efficiency, the natural gas shale revolution. Natural gas is a much more CO2 friendly fuel than something like coal. It's for a lot of reasons, but basically the projected CO2 emissions are now about a third lower than what they were. That's really good news. And then when you look at these temperature rise projections that are quoted in the report and the different scenarios that it runs in the report, it's important to keep in mind, and this is never seems to be emphasized because it takes away from the very dramatic sort of conclusions and media stories, but these temperature increases are projected to occur over a century, over 100 years for it to ultimately appear in the total temperature increase that's being projected. These temperature rises are not showing up next year. Just to give you a flavor for this, the worst case IPCC scenario, it projects a total temperature increase of 4 degrees. And that will result in only 2.7 degrees of an increase this century. And we've already experienced 1.1 degrees of that increase since the start of the Industrial Revolution. So when you do that math, you got a 4-degree overall temperature increase projection. That's over a century. Only 2.7 degrees of the 4 is going to occur in this century. And we already got 1.1 degrees of the increase under our belt. We're living with it today with no issues or problems when it comes to people dying from going outside. We're talking basically, when you net it all out, about a 1.6 degree temperature rise under the worst case scenario from the IPCC. Very different than what you read and what you hear. Then, you know, you get away from the IPCC report, you just go across some other sort of news that's being broadcast out there everywhere you look. There was this media drumbeat coming at the end of summer that was talking about how July from this past summer was the hottest month on record in the history of the planet. and it beat the prior champion, which was July, another July of 2016. That was the hottest month on record until July of this year, got the new crown. But guess what? Again, if you look at the details and sort of you drill into the analysis, the margin of error that you had ascribed to the July 2021 temperature measurement was 10 times greater than the amount that July 2021 beat July of 2016 by. So in other words, the result of 2021 July being the hottest month ever, it was effectively statistical noise. The statistical uncertainty dwarfed the incremental increase by a factor of 10. Again, something that you don't hear enough or understand the context of the headline that you're reading and the conclusions that people or the media want to draw from it. Another subject and topic you're hearing constantly about is flooding damage. You'd think by reading and watching the news today that flooding is worse than it's ever been, both when you look at it in terms of the amount of property loss, the dollars of property loss and damage done, as well as fatalities. That is not true on either point. It's not even close. Flooding costs as a share of GDP, guess what? It's plummeted since records started being kept back in 1903. Today, flooding loss or flooding damage is 0.05% of GDP, and that's compared almost 10 times as high that it was in 1903. So 1903 is almost 10 times higher as a percentage of GDP, the dollar loss from flooding events. Yes, today, of course, on absolute dollar damage, that has gone up, right? So the magnitude of the absolute dollars has gone up, but that's because United States GDP has increased 26-fold since 1903, and population has quadrupled since 1903. There's just way more valuable stuff in every city and every coastal area in this nation today versus what was the case in 1903. That's common sense. But on a proportional basis, when you look at things expressed as a percent of GDP, we are in way, way better shape when it comes to flooding damage today than back then. And those are the facts. That's the math. And we're also much more resilient. And by the way, you see the same thing when it comes to fatalities from flooding. Flooding deaths relative to population have plummeted as well since what they were back in the day or back in 1903. The public is frankly being duped by a bunch of what I would call opaque study assumptions. They're being duped by black box climate models that nobody really understands. It's not clear or transparently clear how these models work and how they go about their calculations. And frankly, by a distortion of statistics. And I think I've just given you some examples of each of those. And who's doing this? Well, you know, who tends to benefit or who would stand to benefit by these types of things? I'd see a lot of rent-seeking entities, whether they're corporations or individuals, looking to game and milk the system by using climate change as a way to feed at the trough of the taxpayer and the producer. And we all, I guess, in the end, should have paid much more attention in science, math, and statistics classes when we had the chance. I guess if we would have done that, we wouldn't have been as easy of marks as we are today. So in the words of Michael Stipe and REM, it's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine, at least when it comes to being confident that climate change isn't going to eradicate the human race anytime soon. That 1.1 degrees of Celsius that we paid so far in exchange for the Industrial Revolution and all that came with it for humanity, that is the deal, ladies and gentlemen, of the millennium. Now, let's take all these issues swirling around climate change as a topic, and let's pivot to our next connecting dot, which is sort of the main theme of this episode of The Far Middle, which is the medical profession or the leadership of the medical profession. You've got medical journals that are out there, and I think everyone's familiar with them, that you hear about different studies being reported in this journal or that journal. Why are they there? Well, medical journals exist to further science in the field, to debate issues openly, right? Get to the best possible conclusion, and basically to inquire, right, for progress. And it's progress that we would all enjoy as human beings, because at some point in time, we're all going to be in need of medical attention and medical technology. But that's what medical journals existed to do in the past. That's more of a past tense issue, because that's not the case, unfortunately, anymore. Recently, 220 medical journals, 220. I didn't know there were 220, but apparently there are at least 220. And it's not just any medical journals that were out there. I'm talking about the biggest names in the medical journal game. So I'm talking about the New England Journal of Medicine, Lancet, the British Medical Journal, the biggest names in medical journals all over the world. They joined together to write a joint editorial recently. And this editorial wasn't about a call of action on how we need to cure cancer. It wasn't an update or bringing attention to how we're going to eradicate poverty through medicine. And it wasn't to talk about how we're going to figure out COVID and get a solution to that once and for all. Nope. Instead, this editorial from 220 medical journals was a call for urgent action on climate change. Now, if climate change is left unchecked, according to the medical journal editors, it's going to, and I'm using their term here, it's going to risk catastrophic harm to health that will be impossible to reverse, end quote. That was their terminology. The editors also press for, and again, I'm going to quote from them, fundamental changes in how our societies and economies are organized and how we live, end quote. That sentence right there says quite a lot. I wonder who gets to decide these things. And that statement alone, it should send shivers up and down your spine. Now, this editorial from our 220 editors of the medical journals, they also wanted $100 billion of donations from rich nations to go to poor nations. They also wanted a bunch of debt forgiveness for the developing nations with respect to their debt. Also, the poorer nations can invest in things to battle the climate. And they also stated in this letter that no temperature rise is safe. I found that to be really interesting and counter-logical because that doesn't make any sense. Extreme cold, I don't know if people are aware of this or if our listeners are aware of this, but extreme cold, it's sort of common sense. It kills over three times as many people every year as extreme heat. That comes, by the way, those findings, that three times factor, comes directly from a study in, ironically enough, Lancet, one of the medical journals that is the author of this nonsense on climate change. Higher temperatures are going to result in less deaths from extreme weather, not more, when you net it out from the deaths that you experience annually from extreme cold. So this is nothing new, I guess, with the politicizing of medicine. We've had recent studies that claim extreme weather leads to depression, increased temperatures lead to more suicides, and on it goes. The medical profession, I'm afraid to say, it looks to be like it's in crisis. This editorial, when it comes to climate change and what it is trying to garner resources and attention toward versus what it should be garnering attention and attracting attention and resources to, legitimate issues, it's effectively, from my perspective, a dereliction of duty. It misleads patients, which are all of us. I think it's immoral. I think it's unethical. And I think in many ways, it's a violation of the Hippocratic Oath. Shame on the leaders of the medical profession for engaging in this type of a charade. And while the medical profession is fixated on climate change, it's ignoring legitimate issues that it should be worried about when it comes to human health. And one example of that is our next connecting dot, which is big tech, just as one very prevalent example that's out there today. Now, I don't know if I'm the only one out there that feels this way, but from my perspective, it's becoming increasingly apparent as each day goes by that big tech is making us dumber by the day as a human race. I read something the other day that completely blew my mind, and it was data from Spotify. A lot of you guys, I'm sure, use Spotify, the music streaming app. I use it. But Spotify is great, as most apps are, just from a trove of data. It gives you some insight into where society's head is at any given moment in time. The most popular rendition of Beethoven's Fifth. I'm not a classical music expert, but I do know Beethoven's Fifth. So the most popular rendition of it has been streamed on Spotify about 1.5 million times. Okay, that was something I saw and said, okay, that's fine. 1.5 million times, that's a lot. But then I was continuing to look at the Spotify data, and I compared that to how many times Olivia Rodrigo's hit Driver's License. I don't know if you heard that song, but Driver's License has been streamed 800 million times. Beethoven's Fifth, 1.5 million times. Driver's License, 800 million times. And the 800 million, this is what's really sort of impressive. That was just between January of 21, when it was released, through May of this year. It wasn't even 6 months, 800 million renditions of that song on Spotify. So again, maybe I'm not the only one feeling this, but you take that sort of set of data and how that's dumbing down our culture, dumbing down our society, but then you start to think about the impact it's having on kids, on teens and young adults. And it's not just dumbing us down. I think it's basically hurting a lot of kids and young adults that are out there. Big tech is. The entire online experience, it's designed to be addictive to humans and particularly to teens and kids. So if you thought, you know, tobacco and big tobacco were creating marketing and business models to hook consumers on their products, big tech is no different. And maybe the sort of damage that it does when it comes to big tech and online addiction is more of a mental, different type of a damage than what you saw with tobacco, which was physical. But nevertheless, it is substantial and immaterial damage being done to a wide swath of our demographics and society today. And everybody knows this. I mean, parents know this. I think the kids themselves know this. Big tech certainly knows it. And doctors in the medical profession knows this. The average American adult, it now spends, or he or she spends, over 2 hours a day on social media, not online, on social media. And my sense is they don't come away enriched or feeling better about themselves after those 2 hours. On top of all this, of course, you've been reading, I think the Wall Street Journal did a multi-week expose on this, 60 Minutes had it, but we've had our now famous Facebook whistleblower telling us basically what we already knew. I mean, what I heard, her accusations and what she was putting out there, it was interesting. I mean, I listened, I was intrigued, but there wasn't anything there that shocked me. It's basically things that I'd already supposed. The tech giant and others in that industry, they don't have our best interest in mind, and they look to hook and draw in humans. And why do they want to hook and draw in humans? Because they want to grow revenue, they want to increase stock price, and they want to increase market share. It's just that simple. Now, what should doctors be more worried about today when it comes to teens and kids? There's two options here. Option one, what Instagram is doing to them by design, or option two is what a colorless, odorless, benign gas called CO2 will increase to on a parts per million basis over the next 50 years. There's some food for thought. I know what answer I'm going to pick. And if you didn't like the example of big tech and social media and how that should be something that the medical profession is fixated on instead of climate change, I've got another example that would be beneficial and benefiting society if we would spend, including the medical profession, would invest a lot more interest and care on this subject. And that is the situation of public schools in our big cities. The National Assessment of Educational Progress, it goes through a study periodically that ranks the nation's public schools in proficiencies for things like math and English, and it does it for different grades and it does it for different demographics. You can find scorecards for the big city school districts in our country under the Trial Urban District Assessment. So that's the report that looks at how the big city school districts are doing. And if you want to be outraged, you need to read those reports and those findings and consider the results that are embedded within them. There were 27 big urban districts that reported results for 2019. And what I can tell you is reading through that report is not a single district of the 27 or the 27 urban districts could say that a majority of their Black eighth grade students were proficient in math or reading. Not math and reading, math or reading. That's an outrage. By way of example, New York City, 10% math proficiency and 14% English proficiency for Black eighth grade kids. That is, as I said, an outrage morally and tangibly. What's even more shocking is when, and this is going to actually, I think, frighten you more because it frightened me more. I sort of wanted to reverse that. I said, well, let's look at the cities of the 27 in the report that did the best. Charlotte and Boston were the two cities that did the best that I found. Charlotte, when it came to math, was tops. They came in, this is the top city of the 27 for math proficiency for eighth grade Black students, 24% math proficiency. That's tops. Boston was first out of the 27 in reading proficiency for Black eighth grade students, 20% proficiency. First place. That's the best. This should be, as I said, a national outrage, particularly when you consider all the talk and time that's spent on diversity and the need to address racial inequality. If we don't have the focus and the drive to demand good proficiency, decent proficiencies, respectable proficiencies in math and science and reading and English for minority kids in our big city schools, we've committed a grave failure of heart. And unfortunately, such outrage, it does not exist in the leadership of our biggest cities. You can look at New York City. You can look at other big cities. It's just like the medical profession that we talked about. They're deflecting attention from the real health and welfare issues affecting people and distract with the abstract, like what the future climate is going to do or not do. Please, someone give the American Medical Association a wake-up call and get them focused on the things that matter. Now, we could go on forever talking about things that the medical profession should be obsessing about instead of climate change, but they refuse to. I'll give you a third and final one here on this issue of the Far Middle podcast. And that is the issue that I think affects health and quality of life for millions of Americans. That is how the housing market is becoming prohibitively expensive to the point where it is grinding things like mobility and inclusion to a halt, to a complete halt. Skyrocketing home prices and plummeting affordability, what's causing them? Well, they're being driven by flawed government policies. And this includes everything from regulations that are imposed on owners and builders in the name of, again, tackling climate change, code red for humanity, sustainability, right? All those buzzwords and buzz terms that we hear. We've talked about this a bit on, I think, the last episode of the Far Middle podcast when we were talking about the subject of runaway inflation. But for homes, the subject that I'm talking about now, it's very simple. It's very simple math. It's not even algebra. Just take a big city of choice. I used Atlanta as an example. I had some data from Atlanta. Home prices in Atlanta, they're up 23% year on year. Incomes are up only 3%. So potential homeowners, they're losing big time. The cost of a home is just far outstripping the pace of wage gains and affordability in terms of what they can pay. You can go beyond Atlanta. If you take the nation, the United States in total, median American households would need today to assign over 32% of its income, almost a third of its income, to cover a mortgage. And that's the highest level since 2008. And I don't need to remind you what happened back then with the financial and the housing meltdown. The inability to own a home and all the other inflationary pressures hitting the working poor and the middle class, it's going to end up having consequences. It's going to reduce life expectancies. It's going to increase stress, and it's going to have a host of other medical and quality of life problems. Make no mistake about that. Again, that's common sense. We all know that. And this is also, I mentioned this earlier, it is killing mobility. Mobility is really important because mobility is the very thing that allowed Americans, since there was an America, to get ahead, to improve their station in life. This goes back to New England colonists moving to the Western frontier at the time, which is basically Western Pennsylvania, where I'm at today. It was immigrants moving to the big cities. It was the immigrants' kids moving to the suburbs. It was the California miracle for Oklahomans back in the Dust Bowl days. So there's all kinds of different chapters in our nation's history about how mobility was there, and it just created an immense opportunity for generations to improve their station in life. But not today. Today, mobility is down a third since 2007. That's one of the most underreported or unknown facts that are out there. I think it's just huge. Mobility dropping a third since 2007. Why? Well, in part because the rich and well-to-do in these desired regions or cities where a lot of the growth prospects are and economic opportunity is, they made their property more valuable by creating scarcity through things like these onerous regulations. When you have these onerous regulations and you can't build and you can't increase the supply of homes, that denies the people on the lowest rungs of the economic ladder the ability to move up a rung or two by utilizing mobility and chasing and seizing economic or job opportunities. So the rich class, their assets get inflated, and the rest stay stuck on the rung by design. Where's the medical profession's editorial board on this issue of plummeting home affordability and how it affects the welfare of who knows how many millions of Americans? Where are they on not teaching our kids in big cities to read, write, and do math, and then thus assigning them the lives of unfulfilled potential? Crickets on these issues while the medical journal community grandstands and lectures on the climate and what it's going to do in 100 years from now. Let's bring it home now for this episode of the Far Middle. I think you can tell based on the last couple of minutes of listening that I'm really frustrated with my friends in the medical profession. I think it's easy to tell that. We rely on these talented individuals to preserve our health and to improve our well-being, increase our quality of life, and basically to extend our lives when you get to the bottom of it. you think the profession is laser focused on the next cure for COVID and the next cure for cancer and how we're going to solve dementia and autism and all these other things that are out there across society. But instead, you see that they decide to dive into politics and into an arena they're not trained in and they know nothing about, which is energy policy and climate change and environmentalism. So just to score political points and secure their piece of the appropriation pie, which I assume that's the reasons why they're doing that, that sort of pales in comparison to the opportunity cost of not really honing in on the true issues and risks and opportunities that are out there in the medical field. So when you see your doctor next, let them know that you rely on them for medical services. You don't need to rely on them for energy policy or climate change fortune telling. Your life and my life may be at stake if doctors don't stay focused on healthcare. In our kids' and grandkids' lives, they're going to be economically ruined if doctors insist on supporting flawed policies to tackle things that they know nothing about, like the climate. I hope you like this installment of the Far Middle podcast. Sort of reminds me of that line that Russell Crowe delivered in Gladiator when he asked the crowds, "Are you not entertained?" I hope you were entertained. You can follow me on Twitter @NickDeolius. Check out the website, nickdeolius.com. Till next time, goodbye.